is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: multiple rockets are fired in the Afghan capital Kabul as the United States races against time to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Israeli forces attack Palestinians protesting near the buffer zone in Gaza against the years-long siege of the territory. 18 protesters are wounded. Also, Category 4 Hurricane Ida makes landfall in the U.S. state of Louisiana, leaving more than a million customers without power. Thank you for joining us. With our top story, multiple rockets have been fired at Kabul's international airport on Monday, but were intercepted by a missile defense system. That's according to an unidentified American official. The attack followed a U.S. airstrike in the Afghan capital on Sunday night against a suspected vehicle of the Daesh terror group. Washington said the vehicle was a potential imminent threat to the airport. It also acknowledged the possibility of civilian casualties in the attack. That, as local reports suggest, nine people, including children, were among the victims of the U.S. airstrike. The developments come as the U.S. is racing against time to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Washington says the evacuations are continuing uninterrupted. Last week, over 100 people, including U.S. servicemen, were killed in a bomb blast claimed by Daesh outside of the Kabul airport. Commentator Mike Harris says the U.S. has a history of killing Afghan civilians, but often claims they are accidentally hit during anti-terror aerial operations. Let's take a listen.
U.S. drone strikes have a history of killing many, many millions of civilians in Afghanistan and in Iraq. They have a long history of doing this. It cannot be justified. Drone strikes are supposed to be surgical in nature and supposed to only hit the intended target. There was one time when the U.S. struck a wedding party in Afghanistan and killed 47 innocent people because they thought that there might have been a Taliban leader there. That turned out to be false. I believe this story is false as well. First of all, you can't believe anything that the U.S. media tells you, and you can't believe anything that the U.S. government tells you. They are known to lie to our own people here in particular. in order to try to gin up war, support for a second foray, perhaps going back into Afghanistan, which I hope they do not do. I truly hope that the Taliban shows extreme restraint and does not take the bait and get drawn into further conflict with the U.S., and that the Taliban will guarantee the safety of U.S. citizens getting out of Afghanistan.
Now, the Afghans who haven't got the chance to evacuate out of Kabul say they are worried about their future under Taliban rule. They say they have no idea how life would change or for them, with some saying things have already turned difficult only 2 weeks into Taliban takeover of the capital. Here's more.
The situation is not good for work members, and since the arrival of the Taliban, there is no work.
The future of Afghanistan is clear. Everything has been messed up, and everyone sees that passengers, including little ones and elders, come from everywhere, and they are all without a future.
Everything is expensive now, and the prices are rising. For example, yesterday I bought tomatoes for 50 Afghanis, but I bought them today for 80 Afghanis. The prices are rising every day.
In fact, the Americans do not take us with them and only make fun of us. This is a waste of time for women, children, and elders.
Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinians protesting near the so-called buffer zone in the Gaza Strip against the years of Israeli siege of the territory. Nearly 20 Palestinians were injured after the regime's forces attacked protesters who were venting their anger by burning tires and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. Some protesters also threw stones and Molotov cocktail at Israeli forces. Demonstrators said they will continue their protests until the regime lifts its crippling blockade on the people of Gaza.
The Israeli regime must lift the siege, and it must know very well that the rebellious youth are ready to crush its soldiers, crush the settlers, and confuse them at night. We will not allow our children to starve to death. These activities will continue until the siege on our people is lifted.
At least 11 Palestinians were also injured in similar protests on Saturday after Israeli forces resorted to live fire and tear gas. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The siege and several Israeli wars have destroyed Gaza's economy. In 2018, Gazans launched a protest movement demanding an end to Israel's blockade and the right for Palestinians to return to the land where they were forcibly expelled from after the creation of Israel in 1948. In order to get more information about the protest, I'm joined by Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in the Gaza City. Ashraf, it's good to talk to you. Tell us more about the protests and those who were wounded.
Well, Palestinian youth have been protesting almost on a daily basis since last Saturday to condemn the ongoing Israeli blockade of the enclave. Last night, Israeli forces attacked the protesters. They used live bullets, tear gas, and rubber-coated metal bullets to attack the protesters. At least 18 of the protesters were injured, including one who is in a critical condition. We have to remember that since 2 weeks, Israeli forces have killed two protesters, including a 12-year-old boy who are protesting peacefully in the east of the enclave against the hermetic blockade that's been placed since 2007. What's really sad for Palestinians in Gaza that Egypt is also helping the Israeli regime with this blockade by imposing a proxy blockade against the enclave. Israel also refuses to allow building materials into the enclave to, for Palestinians in Gaza to rebuild their homes and the infrastructure that was destroyed during the Israeli war on May that claimed the lives of scores of Palestinians, including women and children. And as you mentioned, the peaceful protests during 2018 started on March 30th, 2018, when Palestinians launched the Great March of Return. Israeli forces used excessive force against the peaceful protesters, killed nearly 300 protesters, mainly children. Hundreds more suffered permanent disabilities due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the protesters. So the Israeli regime has been doing this for many years, and many here believe that this illegal regime has been emboldened by the fact that Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, have normalized their ties with Tel Aviv, and they believe that such moves by countries, mainly the United Arab Emirates, have given Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim Palestinians and further violate their rights.
Ashraf, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. I've been talking to Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza City. Now let's move on. Iran's foreign minister is in the Syrian capital, Damascus, following his trip to Iraq. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the presence of foreign forces will not contribute to sustainable security and stability in the region. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali reports.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty, and independence in our world, will lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people, the fight on terror, and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The International Organization for Migration has warned about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen. The organization wrote on its Twitter page that the country is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It added that well over 16 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The IOM maintained it reached out to more than 2 million Yemenis last year, providing them with water and hygiene services. The organization highlighted in a report that the Saudi war on Yemen keeps displacing citizens. According to the report, 50,000 Yemenis were forced from their homes in the first half of 2021 alone. Category 4 Hurricane Ida has made landfall in the U.S. state of Louisiana. The hurricane is creating winds up to 240 kilometers per hour. Over 300,000 people are asked to take shelter west of New Orleans. More than 500,000 households are left without power. Utility companies say the outages might last for weeks. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has deployed over 2,400 staff to help with rescue operations. The entire National Guards in Louisiana have also been dispatched to join rescue operations. U.S. President Joe Biden says the devastation is likely to be immense. Colin Campbell says people are facing grave danger if not properly sheltered in place.
And of course, when you have winds this strong, anything that is not really locked down or is in the ground very firmly or very substantively is going to be airborne. That could mean houses, that could mean cars, car parts, that could mean signs, that could mean people that are trying to brave the hurricane, which there are many in Louisiana and parts of the Gulf Coast of the United States who think that they have experience in dealing with hurricanes, so they're going to stay right in place. If they aren't protected, if they aren't in a safe location, they too will be at risk of losing their lives. And that's why you had many health officials and state officials really urging people to leave town and so they're not in the line of this hurricane. Otherwise, it could prove to be very, not just catastrophic, but devastating for businesses, for people, for pets even. And they're expecting this to go on for several hours as the Hurricane Ida does not seem to show any signs of slowing down just yet.
Greek police and protesters have clashed during a demonstration in central Athens against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse a group of people who threw flares and other objects during the protest. More than 7,000 people rallied outside the Greek parliament to protest against the mandatory inoculations. Similar rallies in Athens last month also saw violence. About 5.7 million people out of a total population of 11 million have been fully vaccinated in the country. Thousands have taken to the streets of the German capital to protest the government's coronavirus restrictions. The protesters chanted slogans against vaccination programs and called for an end to the pandemic measures. Some demonstrators clashed with the police. The protest took place despite a ban on demonstrations. Germany is facing a fourth wave of COVID infections. On Sunday, it reported around 8,500 new cases in 24 hours. The government has announced that it will stop offering free tests from October the 11th to push more people to get vaccinated. Moreover, people will need to be vaccinated, test negative, or have a health certificate to enter indoor restaurants and gyms. Officials in Australia's New South Wales warned that hospitals will be overwhelmed in a matter of few months given the rising number of coronavirus infections and related deaths there.
For example, given the case numbers are where they are, I suspect in October we'll probably have the highest number that we do in intensive care. I suspect we've not reached the peak yet there at all. But how hard we work now will make sure we keep people out of hospital, and that's really important.
The Premier urged people to get vaccinated and protect themselves against COVID. Her comments come as New South Wales reported a record number of over 1,200 coronavirus infections on Sunday. It also reported six more deaths. More than half of Australians have been in weeks-long lockdowns as officials struggle to curb the outbreak. Australia has so far reported more than 50,000 infections and nearly 1,000 deaths. Well, that is it for this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
In the limelight.
The US NATO's rhetorical game of nation building and democracy building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called war on terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Javed Nawabi, writer. This article is published under the heading Afghanistan, the Great Deception. Stay tuned for the details of this article. How is it that 40 of the world's most developed countries involved in the U.S. NATO operation supposedly spent more in Afghanistan than they did in implementing the Marshall Plan in Western Europe, and yet somehow still systematically disregarded where that investment needed to go? If sincerely invested, this money would have gone toward building the central state's administrative capacity for social services and law and order, as well as the agricultural sector, since the vast majority of Afghanistan's population has lived in rural areas for the past 20 years, which is also, incidentally, the region from which the Taliban got most of their recruits. The World Bank estimates that 74% of Afghans live in rural areas, but that number is almost certainly an undercount due to the way in which its figures categorize rural residents who have only temporarily moved to cities. Instead, the agricultural sector was willfully neglected, which contributed to the high national unemployment rate of at least 40% in a country where about 70% of the population is under 25 years old. This is rather ironic when the United States and the European Union subsidize their own agricultural sectors, which make up not more than 5% of their national labor forces respectively, about $49 billion and $101 billion just in 2019. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, a country with a total GDP of about $20 billion that they occupied for 20 years, they could not subsidize Afghan farmers enough in order to make the country food self-sufficient while creating jobs in the rural areas. Policies of the United States and NATO, because of its lukewarm commitment to the nation building, systematically undermined building Afghanistan's central state capacity by avoiding giving the majority of the reconstruction aid to the relevant ministries with the excuse that there wasn't sufficient capacity in the Afghan government to absorb the aid, for that there was corruption. However, the corruption was nurtured precisely because the majority of the reconstruction funds went to the U.S. private contractors, which then subcontracted the projects without proper accountability measures, with the end result being that 90% of the reconstruction aid took a round trip, finding its way back to U.S. private security firms, non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, contracts granted to U.S. corporations. Only 2% or less of U.S. spending actually reached the Afghan people in the form of basic infrastructure or poverty-reducing services. The showcasing of the so-called reconstruction investments with high visibility was a way to foster global perceptions about the generosity of U.S. NATO development projects, which in reality, they were building schools without students and teachers, power plants that were not usable, etc. Unfortunately, instead of appointing government officials based on merit and qualifications, the United States and NATO deliberately chose personnel of neoliberal, Ivy League technocrats and warlords, with their attendant foreign advisors leading the transition government that ultimately became an infestation of corruption run by NGOs and foreign consultants, with little to no state capacity being built. As the U.S.-owned Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's reconstruction, John Sopko, revealed, much of the reconstruction money in the name of Afghanistan was recklessly spent faster than it could be accounted for and properly monitored. For this reason, according to Sopko's report, the U.S. ultimately achieved the opposite of what it intended. It fueled corruption, delegitimized the government, and increased insecurity. Hence, providing the conditions for the resurgence of the Taliban to grow. The last couple of months of negotiations with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar, have further revealed that building a legitimate and professionally staffed Afghan central state with a productive economy for its tax base was never the true intention for Afghanistan, the West Asia region, or the Central Asia region. The U.S. NATO's rhetorical game of nation building and democracy building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called war on terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. The reality is that Afghanistan has become one more bucket list country in the project for New American Century, or PNAC. And again, its women, children, elderly and young will pay the biggest price. Hopefully, the world will awaken from the belief that the United States regime and NATO, with their shameful colonial legacy and their present neo-colonial relations in Latin America, the Caribbean, the West Asia, North Africa region, Southeast Asia, and Africa, can actually bring peace, prosperity, and progress to the global South.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's disastrous legacy in Afghanistan and the consequences of 20-year-long U.S. military adventurism that plunged the war-ravaged country into unimaginable chaos. And we shall discuss how the U.S. longest war spawned terrorism, poverty, corruption, nepotism, warlordism, and human rights abuses in Afghanistan.
After splurging trillions of dollars to decimate the Taliban, causing death, destruction, and displacement, as well as lying to American taxpayers about a disastrous war, U.S. President Joe Biden finally pulled the plug on the 20-year-long adventure, but not before the country plunged into chaos. There are several things that were wrong for the U.S. and allies in Afghanistan, from failed strategy, unrealistic goals, systematic lying, hegemonic ambitions, and failure to win the hearts and minds of people. Afghanistan has for a reason been the graveyard of empires.
Americans invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the devastating events of 9/11 to annihilate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. On the paper, the goal was to capture Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the alleged mastermind of 9/11 attacks. But in reality, then US President George Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wanted full-scale war. They saw it as an opportunity to militarily occupy the mineral-rich country lying at the crossroads of Central Asia and South Asia.
I think the biggest problem was that we did not have strategic focus at the beginning of this conflict. You know, we had known since 1996 that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was a threat to the United States and its allies. And yet from 1996 to 2001, we did not effectively deal with this threat. Even after two U.S. embassies were bombed in Africa, a U.S. naval vessel was bombed in a Yemeni port, and other attacks were made by Al-Qaeda on U.S. interests. And then when 9/11 occurred, the terrorist attacks on the United States in September 11, 2001, we didn't have a plan other than revenge. And revenge is never a plan. Revenge is never a strategy. You know, we, instead of seeking to come up with the best solution to the problem of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we wanted blood. We wanted bodies. We wanted revenge. Our politicians needed to be able to look at the American people and say, we have killed people. We have punished people for the crimes that were perpetrated against us. And anytime you start a war with that mindset, it's not going to go well because you will get distracted. You will get, you know, you will lose track of what you're doing. And this is what happened in Afghanistan.
For the past 20 years, Americans splurged trillions of dollars and dispatched Black Hawks loaded with special commandos to Afghanistan. Contrary to what you hear, it was not done for nation building or promoting peace and democracy. The goal was to consolidate the military control over the landlocked country and make it subservient to the US. But the one thing successive regimes in Washington seemed to disregard was history. From the British in 1839 to the Americans in 2021, foreign powers have always faced defeat and disgrace in the strategically located country. What Americans faced, though, will count as the worst strategic and military debacle of the last century. The way Taliban's much smaller ragtag army pummeled the world's most powerful military carries important lessons. It also bears testimony to America's inglorious legacy of humiliation, surrender, and defeat in Afghanistan.
The dramatic turn of events in the wake of Taliban's takeover of Kabul last week quite clearly demonstrate the failed U.S. foreign policy gambles and lessons unlearned from the such debacles in the past. But the decline and fall in Afghanistan did not unfold just last week. Every year, for the past two decades, desperate and hopeless Afghans have been fleeing their troubled homeland amid rising violence, insecurity, poverty, lawlessness, and corruption. Americans not only failed to keep their promise of building the institutions of governance in Afghanistan, but they also spawned corruption, patronized warlords, emboldened militant groups, and carried out horrendous war crimes.
Neoconservative Americans and their NATO allies, who launched the war in Afghanistan and spent years defending it, are now busy playing blame games over last week's fiasco. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg blamed the Afghan government for Taliban's stunning takeover. Former UK Premier Tony Blair slammed Joe Biden for the imbecile pullout. Former US President Donald Trump fired salvos at both Biden and runaway Afghan President Ashraf Ghani.
Biden's botched exit in Afghanistan is the most astonishing display of gross incompetence by a nation's leader. I've never been a big fan of Ghani. I always said he was a total crook. I've said it for years.
Biden and his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, in turn, washed their hands off the mess. What they refuse to acknowledge is that the debacle has been the result of their own missteps in the war-ravaged country. 20 years down the line, 90% of people in Afghanistan live below poverty line. National economy remains heavily dependent on foreign aid. The country continues to produce third highest number of refugees. There are also around 4 million internally displaced people. Institutions of governance and rule of law lie in shambles. A sizable population is addicted to opium, and around 90% of its supply continues to flow from Afghanistan. Afghanistan remains one of the worst performing countries on the Quality of Life Index. And more importantly, no Afghan sleeps in peace at night. That is the legacy of America's 20-year war in Afghanistan.
20 years on, has the U.S. military occupation in Afghanistan brought peace and security? Has it stemmed the seamless exodus of Afghans? Have the incidents of violence and civilian casualties dropped? The answer is a resounding no. American presence all these years turned the country into a breeding ground for terrorism and organized crime, most of which was aided and abetted by Americans themselves. America will be remembered in Afghanistan for airstrikes, drone strikes, night raids, drug trafficking, corruption, and regional instability.
The stated objective of America's military intervention in Afghanistan in 2001 was to dismantle the sanctuaries of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. After the mission was accomplished, the foreign invaders refused to quit. That effectively paved the way for Taliban's resurgence, which came in the backdrop of horrific war crimes by the US and NATO forces. One of the earliest heart-rending tragedies came in August 2008 when 91 innocent civilians, including 60 children and 16 women, were killed in the US bombing of a small hamlet in western Herat province. The perpetrators got away with it. In 2015, around 40 people were killed in a US airstrike that targeted a hospital in northern Kunduz province. They again got away with it. In between these two massacres, many other mass murders took place. The pandemic of impunity continued even as poor civilians vanished into thin air. Americans had the license to kill. Night raids also came to represent the most terrifying tactics of war in Afghanistan, like the incident in southeastern Paktia province in 2010, where 5 civilians, including 2 pregnant women, were killed. Incidents like these made Afghans feel unsafe in their own homes. Custodial torture became another problematic part of American legacy in Afghanistan, as the International Criminal Court highlighted in its report in 2017. Americans also patronized and sponsored infamous warlords, drug traffickers, and military contractors in the country, which only bred widespread distrust. Thus, the debacle of the US and the comeback of the Taliban did not happen overnight.
As US Chinook helicopters rushed to evacuate American diplomats from the US embassy in Kabul last week, hours after Taliban laid siege to the city, it was a deja vu moment for many. Almost 46 years ago, the US had airlifted its military and diplomatic figures out of Vietnam after Saigon fell to the North Vietnamese forces. Although Biden insisted that Kabul was not Saigon, the comparisons were natural. The images of a Chinook helicopter circling above the US embassy in Kabul underscored how Americans had failed to learn lessons from Saigon, repeating the same blunders and facing the same results.
Both Afghanistan and Vietnam bear striking similarity in terms of the American legacy of lies. Pentagon Papers, the secret government documents published in 1971, illustrated how then US President Lyndon Johnson systematically lied about the US military operations in Vietnam. Almost 48 years on in 2019, Afghanistan Papers published by the Washington Post disclosed the pattern of lies and obfuscations about America's war in Afghanistan.
The biggest commonality is American hubris, the notion that we can come in and we can dictate a solution. We tried that in Vietnam, and we failed because, once again, we supported a corrupt government that was operating against a legitimate, popular resistance in the Viet Cong and a legitimate government in North Vietnam that was supporting the Viet Cong. We were never going to win in South Vietnam. And in Afghanistan, the same thing. We came in and we removed the Taliban, but, you know, we kept treating the Taliban as if it were some sort of foreign entity instead of recognizing that the Taliban was an expression of Pashtun tribal reality, that they were Afghan. And so you can't sit there and say, well, we're going to remove the Taliban, because the Taliban is Afghanistan. It's an Afghan reality. And the fact that the Taliban survived 20 years of incessant warfare and emerged stronger today than they were in 2001 is proof positive that many Afghan people support the Taliban, support what it represents.
According to Afghanistan Papers, statistics about massive losses suffered by Americans and their allies in Afghanistan were manipulated, and warnings about the Taliban's resurgence were suppressed by the Pentagon to paint a rosy picture of the war, which translated into the biggest military debacle. It said the U.S. military had resorted to an old tactic from Vietnam and Afghanistan, manipulating public opinion. It didn't happen overnight. From George Bush to Joe Biden, all American presidents have been complicit in the catastrophic situation in Afghanistan, especially by perpetuating delusions about the unwinnable war. In 2015, a senior U.S. military general in Afghanistan went on record saying the U.S. forces were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, and they didn't have the foggiest notion of what they were undertaking. That happens when invaders lose the plot. The war in Afghanistan, like the war in Vietnam, was based on false premises and was bound to result in a disaster. Will Americans take lessons from it or repeat the same missteps somewhere else? Only time will tell.
The only people that can hold the United States to account are the American people. And while I'm hopeful that the American people will look back on what has happened, be embarrassed by this, and seek some sort of accounting of a leadership, an American leadership that has lied to them for 20 years, it isn't going to happen. The American people were not vested in Afghanistan. We didn't lose enough American soldiers. I mean, you know, 2,400 is a lot, but not enough to make the American people care. Tens of thousands of wounded is a lot, but not enough to make the American people care.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mark Sloboda, an international relations and security analyst. Before we begin, I would like to welcome Mr. Sloboda to the program. Now, sir, Afghanistan is perhaps the worst strategic, diplomatic, and military debacle of the last century. So what went wrong for the U.S. in its longest war?
Well, the primary problem that the U.S. faced is an incompatibility of its means with its mission once they got on the ground. If the United States had restricted themselves to simply a counter-terrorism mission to defeat, strike the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan, which was their original and primary rhetorical target, then they probably would have had a great deal of success. But instead, the George W. Bush administration envisioned their mission in Afghanistan as an invasion, a military occupation, and a reorganization of Afghani society and culture along American lines, which is to say nation building. And where they failed is a nation building mission. They failed to win or to change the hearts and minds of the Afghan people to accept a U.S. light installed political system and society on them. And the every single U.S. nation built mission in you know, the last few decades has failed. And Afghanistan, the longest standing one with the most money invested, nonetheless failed more spectacularly even than its others.
Sir, as we know, the Americans invaded Afghanistan in 2001 on the pretext of the so-called war on terror, but 20 years down the line, they have shamelessly retreated. Now, how do you see the U.S. legacy in the war-ravaged country?
Well, the legacy of the United States in the country of Afghanistan will, of course, not be a good one. There have been lots of problems with the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan, war crimes, U.S. soldiers hunting Afghan for trophies, torture, the like, you know, which mar its most, you know, immediate legacy. The failure of the United States to build infrastructure, institutions, schools, actually place a lot of Afghans as remembering the Soviet occupation during the Soviet intervention in the late 1980s, early 1990s, more favorably because of what the Soviet Union, you know, left in its place. The U.S. Is leaving mostly behind military equipment of a light counterterrorism nature. And with the United States itself having spent some, depending on your account, some $2 to $3 trillion of its own taxpayers' money on a essentially completely failed nation-building mission with very little left to show for it.
Mr. Sloboda, with the Americans retreating from the graveyard of empires after 20 marathon years, shouldn't they be held accountable for wreaking havoc in the country?
Should the United States be held accountable for its crimes in Afghanistan? The U.S., in the pursuit of this mission, committed numerous war crimes against the Afghan people. Should it be held accountable for these and for its acts of aggression? Yes, absolutely. Will it be? No, absolutely not. The United States is a member of the U.N. Security Council. Two, a permanent member, two of its partners for its military occupation of Afghanistan, the United Kingdom and France, are also permanent members of the Security Council. And currently, under international law, there really exists no mechanism to hold a permanent member of the Security Council accountable because of their veto power over, you know, not only the International Criminal Court, but the UN Security Council itself. So they will ultimately not be. The only hope for that is the Court of American Public Opinion, and unfortunately that is even less likely.
One last question, sir. Now, with Taliban firmly in control, do you see any role for the U.S. in Afghanistan from now on?
Well, the Taliban is not firmly in control of Afghanistan. First of all, there does remain some political and possibly military resistance in the Panjshir Valley, and this is centered around the figures of the, until recently, U.S.-installed regime vice president, Saleh, who is a figure who has worked closely with the Central Intelligence Agency in the past. And the figure Ahmed Massoud, whom, of course, is the son of his famous Jamhuriyat father. And he is being used as a figurehead by those who seek some type of military resistance in northern Afghanistan, you know, to echo the long Northern Alliance resistance to the Taliban 1.0. But perhaps ultimately the further U.S. role in Afghanistan will be one of spoiler. If they can't control the country, they will make sure that they economically strangle the Taliban, and so doing will try to destabilize the country. Once again, because they fear that Russia and China and Iran, seeking stability in the region and a pathway for the Belt and Road and other economic initiatives, will move into the country. That, of course, does not mean militarily, but it means trying to shore up, a new Taliban government economically. The U.S. will attempt to strangle that with sanctions, with control of the IMF. They've already frozen the Afghan state's international reserves, currency reserves, and they will do everything possible to strangle the economy of an Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban in an attempt to continue to destabilize the situation. If they can't control it, they will want it destabilized for the surrounding Eurasian powers.
Mr. Sloboda, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the turn of events in war-ravaged Afghanistan and the disastrous U.S. legacy.
U.S.-based historian and podcaster Ali Olumi says Taliban took advantage of the system built by the U.S. in Afghanistan, based on corruption, bribes, and payoffs. Ben Norton, a journalist and filmmaker based in Latin America, notes that Americans were not in Afghanistan for nation building, but to exploit its rich mineral resources. European Parliament Mick Wallace asserts that the US-NATO project in Afghanistan was designed to enrich the military-industrial complex at the cost to Afghans. American journalist Kurt Millis quotes from an article by a former U.S. Marine in which he accuses the U.S. politicians, elites, and military leaders of lying about Afghanistan for 20 years. Hu Xijin, a Chinese journalist, notes that defeat in Vietnam buried the American leadership and Kabul did it again, warning that Asia will turn into super graveyard of the U.S. empire.
And that was our episode on the ignominious end to America's longest war in Afghanistan and the disastrous legacy it leaves in the war-ravaged country after 20 long years of military occupation. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden and the majority of lawmakers in the U.S. don't want to talk about the occupation or the settlements. They want Palestine to remain in the background. We need to push it back to the foreground. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jess Mechanic Writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government Wants Palestine to Fade from View. Don't let it. Stay tuned for more. After this much time, you can predict the mainstream news coverage when it comes to Palestine. The headlines move in well-worn cycles. During periods of overt physical violence in the region, the world pays attention. When the conventional violence recedes, so does that attention. Whenever it feels as though we are inching toward a precipice of some kind, shuffling, however, slowly toward change, the horizon blurs and it all fades from headlines once again. While missiles in flight and buildings collapsing to rubble make for engrossing evening news, the ongoing violence in occupied Palestine is far more quotidian in nature. When the explosions stop, the occupation remains. Recently, the Zionist regime began demolishing Palestinian properties in Silwan, a neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, in order to make space for a religious theme park. The baseline violence of everyday life is a malignant force of oppression that undergirds everything else, but it's not worth prime coverage, apparently, much less outrage.